What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast number 213, Hydration, Electrolyte, and Sports Performance. My guest is Mike McKinney from Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. Mike has been on here quite a few times, and it's always a pleasure. It was a lot of fun having him on during the 200th episode, and we talked about some of the greats in athletic training came from his area, and he didn't know anything about it, so we just had fun. Just having the conversation with Mike. So I am Jeremy Jackson, the host of the Sports Medicine Broadcast. Sitting right beside me, I've got
Ariana,
Joshua,
Daniela,
Tiana,
and Tiana. This episode will be sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/hydration. We have Jason Moore logged in live, so he may be asking some questions. And then using hashtag TheSMB, where Diana is on Twitter, she'll be able to catch some of those questions if you have them there if you're watching the live show. Without much further ado, we're going to get to Mike. He has a presentation, which will be in the show notes. If you're watching live, you should be able to see the presentation and Mike, which Daniela will switch to in just a second. So you'll be able to see the presentation and Mike. And then the whole entire presentation that he's going through today is in the show notes and in the post for this episode. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/hydration. All right, Tiana.
Mike, can you give us a working definition of hydration?
A working definition of hydration. So there's the textbook definition that you'll get that's primarily a lot multifactorial. And so really hydration is, if you take it outside of sports, it's making sure something has fluids in it. Considering the amount of fluids that are in the human body, that's usually what we're looking at. What we'll get to is through the presentation, I'll be using some terms that I'm really kind of big on terminology. I don't like to say if people are hydrated or dehydrated. I like to say euhydration or it's a more accurate scientific term for human physiology. So that's kind of, I think, we're going to start. Does that help answer your question a little bit?
Yes.
It's definitely more than just throwing water at people. And you'll see that in a few minutes here. Cool.
Can you give us a working definition of electrolyte?
So electrolytes are the minerals that are necessary for homeostasis in the body. We have a lot of them circulating in around, and basically they make up the cell. So we have your intercellular and extracellular ions. So that can be sodium, potassium, chlorine, magnesium, chloride, obviously from the sodium chloride equation. And those sorts of things are where I'm going to primarily focus. With all the electrolytes in our body, this presentation will primarily focus on sodium and honestly, mostly sodium. And we'll get to why mostly sodium and not potassium or some other electrolytes that are commonly talked about.
And then a working definition of sports performance.
Sports performance. That's probably the hardest question I'm going to have to ask all day. So with sports performance, what we're looking at is, especially in the discussion of hydration and electrolyte loss, is energy system development. So when you're talking about everything that makes up your blood, the fluids in your body and body water, plasma volume, and those sorts of things, that contributes greatly to cardiac output, aerobic capacity, and those sorts of things. So anytime you impact electrolyte loss, hydration, you're by nature going to impact the performance of an athlete. And that can be their performance in sport, from an aerobic capacity standpoint, cardiac output, as I discussed. And these are things that are measurable. So these are things that we can actually look at when you're evaluating an athlete.
All right. So without much further ado, we're going to get to your presentation. So take it away, Mike.
That works. So one of the things I like to talk about and that we can get while they're working on this to get going is the primary objectives that I'm going to talk about are really providing an evidence-based approach to fluid and electrolyte replacement. When we look at fluid and hydration needs in sport, you hear a lot about preventing heat stroke, other types of heat illnesses, and things of that nature, which are obviously very important and at the forefront of our focus as athletic trainers. But what I like to do is back that up a few steps, because in order to adequately prevent these sorts of thermoregulatory issues, we have to be able to hydrate appropriately and properly, which is a lot harder than just saying drink water and won't get heat stroke. This kind of gets at the behavior and how we actually should go about doing this. Again, as I kind of alluded to before, the normal hydrated state and normal body water content in the human body. So usually when you're reading research associated with fluid balance and things like that, these are the terms they use. Hypohydrated is a state of body water, and that's what we like to talk in, states, not necessarily a process, which is dehydrated, is the process or loss of body water. So if I say I'm dehydrating fruit, that's a more appropriate use of that word. And so sometimes I'll even catch myself doing the same thing, because for the sake of just communication, I like people to understand what I'm saying. But for the purpose of this, and if you want to understand the evidence that we're going to present, euhydrated and hypohydrated is the terms we like to use. So if you go on to the next slide, hopefully this isn't too much down the chemistry road for a lot of you, but again, osmolality is the total solute per kilogram of solvent in the body, and concentration is the amount of solute in a given volume or solvent. So why this matters is when we talk about sodium in the bloodstream, we usually talk about the osmolality of the total blood, you know, milliosmoles per kilogram. So a normal human's 137 milliosmoles per kilogram of sodium, and the concentration is the concentration is what we're going after, and with 142 millimoles per liter. So ignore what I just said, I was just reading off my notes incorrectly. So that's what we're going after with that. And if you go to the next slide, this is kind of where we need to start. So when we talk about hydration, we need to talk about human averages. So we'll get to some things in a minute that, depending on who you talk to, you'll talk to these athletes to say, I'm a salty sweater, I lose a ton of fluids. Or some people that are like, you know, I work the same amount, I don't lose very much. And so this can be, both athletes are correct, but for the sake of this presentation and keeping everything fairly consistent, we're just going to have to go off reported means for now. So on average, to lose between 1 to 2 liters per hour of sweat, and it's the primary cause of weight loss during activity. This is completely normal. During exercise, don't worry about it. These things happen. Unless they're urinating, they have cases of diarrhea or vomiting, really this is going to be how it's exiting the body. The concentrations of electrolytes in the sweat also need to be considered with fluid losses, because this is where you're going to primarily lose things. And I want you to take note, and you don't have to be able to convert millimoles per grams, although I did do that for everybody if you take a look at the presentation, but sodium is the greatest electrolyte lost in sweat. It's 55 millimoles per liter, or 1.2 grams. Potassium's only 5. And so if you look at the differences between these, you can see why our primary ion that we're paying attention to is sodium and not necessarily potassium, calcium, magnesium, or chloride, which I don't have listed here. And then as a result, our blood plasma sodium concentration is going to be anywhere between 137 and 142. These are baselines. I can take a blood sample from me, grab somebody out of the hallway. This is homeostasis. We're all going to be pretty close to this, assuming we're healthy. So these are the basics that we want to start with. Go ahead to the next slide. And so I like to start this off. A mentor of mine in grad school always gave this real world example just to kind of demonstrate how much fluids and electrolytes people actually lose during exercise. And it's just using, again, these averages. So if we assume a scenario of a 165-pound athlete competes for an hour and a half practice, this is pretty normal. Say they sweat the higher end of that, 2 liters per hour, and their sweat sodium concentration is 55 millimoles per liter, and their sweat potassium is 5 millimoles per liter. This is your average human. Now, assume they don't drink anything, which unfortunately is shockingly common. Don't do this. This is one of those things that we want to make sure, you know, we as athletic trainers are encouraging people to drink, so sometimes this isn't a problem. And then they don't urinate. This is fairly typical. Once they get out on practice, they practice, and then they go. And assuming they drink Powerade for rehydration and electrolyte replacement. Now, I put our other similar sports drink. This isn't to necessarily pick on Powerade. This is just what I happen to have here in sports medicine, and I had their nutrition labels. So this is what I did the math based off of. So that's some of the things that we want to look at. So keep this example in mind as we go through. So the results of that equation, so they would lose about 3 liters of fluid, which ends up being about 4% of their body weight. And so we do know that after 2% loss through numerous research articles, that they're going to have a decrease in aerobic output. And these are things that we need to keep in mind as athletic trainers, because on the sports medicine side of things, obviously the medical side is very important, but many of us work in settings where being able to contribute to an athlete's performance is also a big deal for us. And so being able to manage manage both sides of that coin can be very useful. The recommendations for replacement are usually based off of 150% of fluid loss, which is Sharef's et al. Found that in the mid-90s. And basically that's because the length of time it takes to replace fluid, you're urinating over that process. And so by the time you reach full euhydrated status, you have replaced 150% of fluids lost. So for this particular athlete, that's 3 liters of fluid. Now, that's if it was just water. Now we need to take into account what happens if we lose sodium to go with it. So assuming they have the average sweat sodium that we talked about, they're going to lose anywhere between 160 to 165 millimoles per liter. And that's just simple math. That's their concentration per hour with sweat rate, which is 3.7 grams of sodium. Okay. For the, just for reference, the FDA recommends that normal humans age 14 and older ingest 2.3 to 2.6 grams of sodium per day, assuming they're healthy and there's no other extraneous issues going on. This is important because that means our athletes fall into a special population where they're losing more than these national entities assume they have. So we need to take an account.
Mike, if I have a question, you want me to wait till the end, or you want me to go?
Oh, no. Stop me as we go. Stop me.
Okay, so if I lose 2 liters per hour, then why would I need to replace 3 liters? Why do I need to get to 150 in percent of the water volume lost?
Sure. So one of the things that our body does is after exercise, obviously we want to replace 100% because that's what we lost. Right. The reason we say 150 is because rehydration takes up to, can be anywhere between 4 to 6 hours after activity to get back to where you need to be. So as you're intaking these fluids, your body's still actively, your kidneys are filtering your blood, getting rid of this fluid through urination. So you're still losing fluids just in a different and slower method because you're not urinating all the time. So between free water loss through urination over this 4 to 6 hour period, the equations usually work out. In that particular study with Sharef's, that's where they found it took 150% over that time period to actually get people to 100%, if that makes any sense.
All right. Yeah, I get you. Because you have to account for the urination and the time and all the other stuff during. Okay.
Correct.
All right.
Yeah. So any questions, stop me as we go, because this is a presentation I've designed for classroom learning. So this is, I'm used to like hands going up and stopping and making sure everybody's on the same page as we go.
All right.
And so with that sodium loss, I wanted to add the potassium because they only really lose about 0.5 gram of potassium. And if you pay attention to any nutrition labels and things like that, this demonstrates why the need to supplement potassium with all these extra products that are on the market really aren't necessary. If you just have a colorful salad, eat a handful of apricots, a potato, you get all the potassium you can lose in an exercise with that type of replacement idea. So sodium is really where the ball game is with electrolyte replacement. So go ahead and go to the next slide. So this slide's a little, this is definitely where people start to ask, you know, questions and slow down a little bit, and that's fine because this is about as far as we're going to get into biochem in this presentation outside of the practical side of things. Basically, the reason we have electrolytes in our bodies, they maintain the balance of fluid inside and outside of the cells. So they need to basically create an environment for cellular health. Sodium's the primary outside the cell. Potassium's the primary ion inside the cell. And this area contains the majority of your body water and is that intracellular space. So what we want to make sure is that this is in balance. The extracellular compartment is the environment for cell function. So what happens is water's constantly moving in an like concentration is one of them. And that's why this balance is important, because if it gets thrown off, water's not going to go effectively where it needs to, and this can really negatively impact the performance of an athlete. During exercise, you lose water, both water and electrolytes, causing imbalances in the system, which causes a decrease in plasma volume. So that's that aerobic capacity where people, even if they're not undergoing heat illness and slowing down, which is a big, you know, concern of athletic trainers, this is where you see the hotter an athlete gets and the more tired he gets, this is the practical reason why. Its plasma volume is decreased because of fluid loss. Decrease in venous arterial pressures, and that's cardiac output. Those two go hand in hand. The release of AVP, so what this is this is your body saying, I have to try and hold on to this water, and that's a direct result of the increase in plasma osmolality and increase in thirst. I threw on, there's no scientific link to muscle cramping with this process because nobody's actually been able to prove it. In fact, repeated studies, retrospective analysis have not been able to actually do a link. A lot of the studies with this particular process causing muscle cramping actually make a lot of assumptions on what they're causing. They haven't been actually able to prove it. So I just want to keep that in mind with everybody. Now, this isn't to say that if you have a whole body, a gross fluid loss that you'll see in like marathon runners and things like that, that you won't see someone in like whole body cramping because of a great fluid loss. That definitely does occur. But this is more along the lines of if you have a football player that has right calf cramps every third to fourth quarter when it's hot outside, it's very unlikely that this is the cause of that cramp.
When we were talking to Theron and Bobby about the soccer injuries, we talked about cramping, because soccer players, they tend to cramp a lot towards the end of the game. And correct. They said, for the most part, it's muscle fatigue rather than hydration.
Yes, I would 100% agree with that. And it's multifactorial. So if we talk about it from a muscle fatigue standpoint, what fatigues muscle? And it can be either A, just repetitive action, or it can also be abandoning form. And now you're stressing this muscle group in a different way than you're used to stressing it. And so hydration might be able to play a role there, because if you get tired later, you're not going to break down your form as well. And I think that's where people start to make that link a little bit, but it's not a direct A causes B. Otherwise, we'd be able to reliably reproduce it in an environment. So I definitely agree it's more of a CNS, central fatigue, even local fatigue. There's some studies where they're able to induce cramping distal to a nerve block. So it's not the signal doesn't have to go all the way up the chain, which are some pretty interesting studies to read. I've also got another couple case studies that show they cured hamstring cramping in a triathlete. And I say literally cured because the guy didn't have any resurgence of it, just simply by going through a glute activation protocol over 26 weeks and correcting his form. And that was hamstring cramping stopped. So, and this is a guy that does Ironman and, ultra marathons and that sort of thing. So where fluid losses would be pretty great. So it's an interesting, definitely, I think the research is moving in that, the neurophysiology of things rather than nuts and bolts, straight up electrolyte loss. Okay. Any other questions about this before we go on?
I don't think so.
Cool. This is just one of the harder slides to kind of get through, but you can see on the next slide, this is kind of the meat and potatoes of everything. So when we drink something, eat something, doesn't matter. Gastric emptying is the gatekeeper. So even if it goes into my stomach, it's not necessarily being utilized. And this is where a lot of us make arguments on these products people take during, before, and after sport. Are they working when they say they're working? Because realistically, this is one of the many factors, or one of the primary factors that's going to contribute to how quickly or how slowly these products work. My research that we'll get to towards the end with pickle juice is specifically geared towards assumptions made based off gastric emptying. So the stomach doesn't really absorb many things except it's assumed it's some trace amounts of water and some trace vitamins, but realistically it's holding on to everything until it empties into the small intestine. The rate that fluid leaves the stomach determines the hydration electrolyte replacement, the efficiency of things. And this is where you get into, if you read the textbooks, that 6% carbohydrate solution. That's where we're kind of going with this. Unfortunately, if you get to if you see the next point here where it says things that slow gastric emptying, you can just put hashtag sports, which is exercise intensity, low pH, volume ingested, and high osmolality. These four things basically represent a lot of the products people ingest during, before, and after athletics. So obviously exercise intensity, as that goes up, gastric emptying goes down. So whatever you eat or drink is going to leave your stomach slower. Lower pHs, so things like pickle juice, mustard, fruits and products like that are going to leave your stomach slower. Small volumes are going to leave the stomach slower. Our stomach actually will empty quicker if it has a rapid expansion in volume. So just like a little squirt from my water bottle won't necessarily immediately leave my stomach. And the high osmolality is also going to leave the stomach pretty slow. And these are where you notice things like gator lights, or people are dumping table salts. And this is pretty common during games, or like drinking straight up chicken broth. For the vast majority of our sports, this is going to not be utilized in their system in a time frame ideally you would like it to. The composition of the beverage can have a significant impact on fluid replacement. Water follows salt, and then sugar. So go to the next slide for me. And this is a picture that basically describes how our small intestine works. It uses both active and passive transport. So if you want to know why Gatorade, Powerade, or any of these sports drinks are, they're composed of the things they are, this is why. So basically the SGLT1, GLUT5 are active transport molecules that require different types of sugars or carbs to bind to them in order to help bring water through the small intestine. But the cool thing about water is it goes actively and passively. So by composing the drinks the way they do, is trying to improve this absorption rate and get fluid into your system faster. Now, that while this matters for fluids, this might not necessarily matter for electrolytes. You can even see the SGLT1 requires sodium and glucose and helps open that gate up for sodium, or sorry, water to come through. So that's why, as far as, I don't really beat up too much on the sports drink companies, because I think you can use those for fluid replacement. It's when we get to discussions of electrolyte replacement that things start to go a little bit away from what is necessarily advertised. Do you have any questions about this, Jeremy, before we go on?
No, I kind of want to see the whole picture and it comes back. I mean, you know, I understand. I remember in anatomy we were talking about the gate, and it has to have both of these keys to go through.
Correct.
But kind of want to see your recommendation, see at the end, you know, how we can best apply this to the athletes. So
absolutely. And so if you go to the next slide, basically this exists because I just wanted to show, from a marketing standpoint, there's a lot of stuff that athletes are bombarded with on a daily basis, and you don't expect athletes to be the experts, but that's what we are as athletic trainers, and obviously other healthcare practitioners that may be listening in. If you look at these advertising campaigns, they're very successful in what they do. There's a lot of money behind them. And the Powerade one I specifically take issue with, because it says it replaces electrolytes in the same ratio typically lost in sweat. And I'm just honestly going to say out front that that's not true. And you'll see that in a second. And these are the things that a lot of, again, they're bombarded with, and it's up to us to kind of, athletes are going to come to you. They're going to ask about this. And this is up to us to really kind of wade through the research and kind of tell people what to look at and what not to look at.
So does Powerade make that claim because it has the same ratio in its formula, like that we lose, like they take sweat and they analyze it and then they say, okay, well, we're going to put the same sodium and potassium and water volumes in Powerade and then that should make them equal? Is that where they get that from?
I think what they're, the way they're really formulated is to match the osmolality and concentration of our blood, kind of to be what's called isotonic and level straight across. So it's utilized in your body a little bit better. And I think in that regard, those claims are actually true. But when they say you're going to lose the same ratio of you're going to replace the same ratio of electrolytes that you lose, that's just simply not true. And I'll show you that in a second, because I've got a visual, if you've looked through the presentation, of how much of a sports drink it would take to actually replace the amount of sodium an average athlete would lose. And then we'll talk about that in a second. So if you go on to the next slide, this isn't insider information or anything like that. This is me basically taking information off the back of a nutrition label. So when they say they have sodium at 100 milligrams, and this is per 8-ounce serving, so this is the powder you buy in the big containers, that's 18.4 millimoles per liter. Now remember, that's per liter, and our hypothetical example lost 164 millimoles per liter of sodium. And then potassium was even a little bit lower. But you can see the potassium is probably sufficient, so we don't have to worry about that. The most common one I like to use is the bottle, because most of our athletes will go to Sam's, Costco, they'll buy the 24 packs of any type of sports drink and use that for their own vending machines in school campuses, that sort of thing, are actually a little bit lower in their concentrations and don't actually have the same amount as the powder that we usually give our athletes. And again, this is not just beating up on Powerade necessarily. The label over to the right here on the screen is I took from a just a Gatorade bottle. They're pretty close. They have different and different compositions, but the end goal is the same. Again, they're most commercially available, and they're pretty much sold in bulk. So this is pretty. This is a pretty common behavior among athletes. If you go to the next slide.
All right. So on that, is that if you mix like a normally the bag of Powerade powder or Gatorade powder is the Gatorade powder is 6 gallons. So if you mix straight up 6 gallons with the powder and no ice, or does that factor into it? Or
yeah, the ice will factor into it because as that melts, you're going to slowly add more basically a hypotonic solution to it, and it's going to dilute the overall concentration that an athlete will get if they use a cup or water bottle or whatever. So that's just assuming you follow their instructions on the back and you haven't added anything, which a lot of people don't. You know, they just work studies, student athletic trainers, they make it, push it out to the field, and that's so. I think across the board, that's a more common practice than adding anything additional.
Okay.
So with this slide, basically, for our hypothetical athlete, if they lost 165 millimoles per liter of sodium, and there's only 10 to 11 millimoles per liter per bottle, they would have to drink 15 bottles of Powerade just to replace the sodium from that one exercise session. And this is why I really want to put a focus on this and pull from my mentor in grad school, because I thought it really put it in a perspective, a visual of how much this actually is. If you read my post on the BOC blog a couple months ago about hyponatremia, this actually, an athlete died from trying to consume this much fluid to replace electrolytes because he was cramping and all sorts of things. We'll talk about that in a few. But this is really what this is. And then that's also, if you just drink from powder, that means an athlete would have to sit there next to the cooler and drink 9 liters to get their sodium back. So obviously that's not very practical in any sense of the word.
All right, so 9 liters is how many gallons? I'll Google it real quick.
Yeah, I'm just doing the math in my head. I think it's close to 5 gallons. Like they would have to walk around with their own little 5 gallon.
So it's 2.4 gallons.
Yeah, 2.4 gallons. So you can imagine that's an enormous amount of fluid for anybody to consume on a regular basis following following activity. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see the potassium is still pretty high. Like that's 6 liters of sports drinks. This is really difficult for people to do. And not only that, like how practical is this? I mean, somebody would be making a trip to Costco every other day just to buy the, and that's per athlete. So if you have a full football program, 3 teams, that's 120 athletes. How is this possible that you could do this? And that's where we have to take other strategies.
All right, so kind of going back to the beginning, this is based off of 1.5 hour exercise. So just say a normal basketball practice.
Yeah, normal basketball practice, maybe in-season football. But then we start getting into, you know, especially you guys down in Texas, what do you do for 2-a-days?
Right.
So now you're really kind of doubling down on these losses. And this is just an average athlete, average time. And then you get these what are usually outlined as scenarios but are common in places that we start, you know, having some really dangerous situations here. And that's one of the things we want to look at going through the rest of these the examples that I have in this presentation. So if you go to the next slide, it kind of gets it to what I'm talking about. And it's extremely dangerous to do this because essentially kind of what I talked about with the composition of these drinks, they're fairly isotonic to human blood. If you add isotonic to isotonic solutions, you dilute the whole solution in general. So in general, if you were to drink this much sodium, you're going to overall lower your plasma sodium concentration by drinking that much fluid that close to exercise. It'll cause hyponatremia and can result in death. And that's when we talked about that Zyres Oliver, that student in Georgia in 2014, that unfortunately this occurred to. He drank close to 4 gallons of fluid, sports drinks, and water, and ended up, you know, obviously a result that none of us hope to ever have to experience. And this is just with averages. One of the things I always like to bring up, and I kind of talked about this, I did a blog post on sodium on the BOC that came out, I think, last week. some two-a-day, there's data from NFL players that during two-a-days, they can lose up to 17 grams of sodium, okay? And we have hard data that shows us this. So this is actually a really big, widespread problem. And then if you don't have sodium in your body's not going to retain water. So this is directly going to impact the hydration status of this athlete. Interestingly, these sodium fluid losses and sweat rates are largely genetic. So even at the highest level, that athlete could be existing at your high school level as well. They could be losing that much and you just don't know it. And that's why you find later in the season, these people you're always behind with, they're never catching up. This is usually the case, is it's insufficient in replacement. So if you go on to the next slide, this is where everybody's like, okay, so you just spent 15 or 16 slides telling me that nothing I do works and it's a lost cause. It's not a lost cause. There is practical application, but it's how and when you do it. So one of the first things I like to talk about is, go on to the next slide. This particular study was done in 2003, but continuously gets reference to is what happens if you try and replace all your fluids lost during the entire exercise period, and this is actually incredibly dangerous. So what these people did is they drank 135 U.S. ounces during exercise to replace exactly what they were losing. So prior to the study, they did the math, and Chwer and Bolden, their colleagues, did the calculations and made sure that they replaced this as they went through this exercise protocol, so they actually did not lose weight. There was multiple trials with high sodium, low sodium, and water, and our sports drink example would fall under the L, if you look at the slide, which would be their low sodium trial, which is about 1,687 milligrams of sodium or 1.6 grams. One of the things that came from the study is by people drinking that much, go on to the next slide for me, 92% of the subjects in the low sodium trial, so that's drinking a sports drink essentially, had lower plasma sodium at the end of exercise. And this is something that I think is a big take-home message so far for athletic trainers, is if we're trying to prevent the sodium loss, this type of behavior can actually contribute to it when we think we're actually doing good, we're actually doing harm. And then 69% of those subjects actually developed mild hyponatremia. So we're actually creating a medical condition by giving people during exercise. This particular study was actually a little bit dangerous on some respects because they actually had two subjects have to be hospitalized in the group that 92% of them developed hyponatremia clinically, and that's drinking only water to replace all their weight lost during exercise. If you read the new hyponatremia position statements that came out at the end of last year, this is what they've always termed over drinking, but this is what they're talking about, is you're lowering your plasma sodium by over drinking. Water or basically hypotonic or isotonic fluids. And so these are the things that we want to seek to prevent as athletic trainers. So if you go on to the next slide, so what happens if we just leave them to their own devices? I like this study a lot by Dr. Folks-Kodek because it's one of the things that kind of demonstrates that even at very different levels of football, similar things happen. So basically what they did with the study is they did all the sweat tests that I was talking about. This particular study actually showed us the sweat rates that I was talking about earlier, up to 17 grams of sodium lost in a single day by one player. But these athletes were left to their own devices. So basically like any football practice, just drinking whatever they want when they want. Now when this has different access to fluids, one of these schools is a Division II football program. The other one was a professional. A tray of all the products, all the different hydration products, like that's what they had access to. Interestingly, the college group who had access to water only, no Gatorade, no Powerade, actually replaced similar amounts of fluid as the NFL players who had access to everything. And they could drink whatever they want. And then the college players really kind of had controlled rehydration periods during practice. And realistically, they only replaced roughly 60 to 70% of their fluids lost, which was interesting to see because that's actually a normal human response. When our thirst cuts off as humans, we're only actually about 70 or so percent hydrated. And this is something we've known since the late 70s, 80s. And for some reason, people really don't pay attention to it. So this whole just drink until you're no longer thirsty and then you're hydrated is not accurate advice. And here's a study that actually demonstrates that. All these subjects in the study, none of them were hydrated, just drinking, so they were no longer thirsty. So I'm just updating my slides here. So go on to the next slide, and this kind of talks about the numbers behind that. So that 65 to 85% I talked about, this is the term we call ad libitum, or as needed. These are also, this isn't just football in the study I showed. This is also youth football and professional and collegiate football and other studies that we've also referenced. But what we have found is ad libitum ingestion is optimal for performance. Rates higher than ad libitum can introduce health problems. And this is where we get to the study I talked about a few slides ago with Schwerenwald, is they're gaining weight or they're maintaining weight during exercise. It's actually a negative from a performance aspect and can cause gastric discomfort. If they're drinking too much, they can gain weight. So when you're dealing with these highly tuned athletes that compete over a distance, water weighs something. If you keep introducing water, especially over the course of things like, say, marathon, they're not trained to compete with this additional weight in addition to the physiological aspects of what might be happening with their plasma sodium concentrations.
All right, so ad libitum means as needed?
As needed.
So the ones that ended up performing better was as needed. Now, when we were talking with the marathon medicine, Dr. Sionka, they were saying that the drinking the fluids, a lot of people will drink the fluids because they're hot, but the drinking of the fluids doesn't aid in cooling down at all. It just, we've kind of conditioned ourselves to drink something cold when we're hot. Now, how do we know as needed? Are you going to get to that later?
So as needed is simply like, I've got a water bottle here, so I periodically get a little thirsty, so I drink as needed. Or you'll see this in football a lot. Maybe the athlete's not thirsty, coach blows a whistle, they're changing drills, and he just grabs water because he knows that's time for him to grab water. Totally uncontrolled based off the behavior of the athlete. That's typically what that means. The term that they're starting to use now is drink to thirst, which is where I only drink if I'm thirsty. So right now, I'm drinking to thirst. As I talk, I get thirsty, then I'll have some water to kind of fight that off a little bit. And that's more the behavior we're kind of moving towards as far as a recommendation standpoint.
All right.
Yeah, so moving on. So basically now we have the information of, here's kind of it. These behaviors that we've typically done and these recommendations. So telling people to only drink when they're thirsty, okay, so cool. They're gonna all of a sudden get rehydrated. That's not necessarily true. Now in the rehydration period, this is where we focus a lot of our efforts, a lot of products focus things. I'm gonna show you a couple different ways it actually, honestly doesn't matter. So rehydration with drinks differing in sodium concentration recovery from moderate hypohydration. And this is by Stuart Merson and Robert Mann. And what they did is they exercised and gave people three different conditions of fluids that you can see in the upper right-hand corner if you're watching that table on the upper right. And what that is that's giving you different sodium contents. So the 1, 31, 40, and 50 millimoles per liter. Now remember, back to our sports drink example, most commercially available sports drinks fall somewhere in the neighborhood between that 1 and 31. So you can look at that particular box to see where we're at with that. So you can see the cool thing with this is, so they go through that downward spike in this particular graph shows their exercise period where they lose fluids. Everybody did the same thing. And regardless of what condition they were in, they all rehydrated. So when they go across this zero, this baseline, they all go there. What you notice is the decay of these lines is different depending on how much sodium they ingested. So this gets back to the gastric emptying of things, what helps water get into the system and what helps your body retain that water. Interestingly, for those watching, I have a red circle around it, but I'll describe it to those just listening, is that as we get below normal fluid balance, or what we would start calling people hypohydrated, that happens about 2 hours after the hydration period has ended, regardless of what they drank. And so this includes everything from water all the way up to 50 millimoles per liter of sodium, which is a significant amount of me saying adding table salt into my water bottle. And this is assuming they drink nothing else. Now, for those, I started my career out in the high school setting, so I do know that this is pretty common behavior, but I honestly still see it even at the college level as well, that athletes will be really diligent in this hour or so after exercise. Like, hey, I got to get my protein, my shake, got to get my water. Then they go to class and they go home. Then they start doing all these other things, and that hydration kind of falls off until the next day. So what this is showing is that 2 to 3 hour period, if you do nothing else, you're going to end up in fluid deficit regardless of what you drink. And so this demonstrates the importance of encouraging throughout the evening, not just immediately following exercise. They crush a water bottle and they think they're fine. The next study go over is by Evans, and this is again post-exercise rehydration, but now they're looking at different carbohydrate content. So now sodium stays the same. Now we're looking at, when you look at your textbooks, or you look in at least the textbook I had in school, The Prentice, where it says the 6 to 8% carbohydrate solution is best for gastric emptying. This is what they were modifying. Now they did that ad libitum ingestion. They let people drink to whatever. So if you look at this, if you're watching along and can compare, and just go ahead and click to the slide before, you'll see this dip in exercise, and then go back to your next slide. It's the same. So they're having that same decrease regardless of exercise and regardless of rehydrate. So basically drinking water or up to a 10% carbohydrate solution did matter. They all achieved this rehydration period. Same thing though, this line across is basically what's considered hydrated. By about hour two, we're falling into this negative fluid balance again, except in this one group that had the 10% carbohydrate solution. So what that's telling us is and I think Powerade, off the top of my head, I'd have to go back and look at a label, I think is a 10% carb solution, has a slower decline in fluid balance over this 4 to 6 hour period. And so, Jeremy, this is the demonstration of your first question of why 150% is because during this period that you see on these graphs, at hour one, hour two, hour three, they're going down. So you need to keep drinking to come up above that baseline, and that's where it equals out to be 150%.
All right, so are you going to get to, I guess, practical steps or advice like later on at the end?
Yes.
Okay.
Cool. And I wanted to show this study because this is the Sharef study that I was getting to, and this is where they exercised the 2% fluid losses and rehydration with varying amounts of sodium. 100 millimoles per liter maintained fluid balance above baseline. That's important to know since most of the sports drinks we provide athletes at all of our sporting events only reach somewhere in the neighborhood of 16 to 30. I think the international variants of Powerade, if we have any international listeners, the international variants of some of these sports drinks have higher sodium contents. But this is significant. 100 millimoles per liter that's a lot of salt, to be honest with you. That's like where you have liter grams of sodium in your drink. And that's what they had to do to maintain fluid balance after exercise. So that's what we're looking at. And where this works from a performance standpoint. So if you go on to the next slide, you can skip that. That's fine. So what we're doing is now we're getting into thermoregulation and endurance performance. So this is kind of the practical application that I talked about before of where you see this. This particular study was done on a bike. And what they did is they did sodium facilitated hypervolemia. So what this is instead of focusing so much on the post-exercise hydration period, you spend a lot of time on, this is people loading people with sodium before, during the day, before exercise, and then having them go through, go through a protocol, trying to get that, that expansion of plasma that is your body's retaining water with sodium. And what they found is these people did a cycling time trial. So they did the same protocol, all things considered, except we had the other group that did sodium loading prior. During that 10-minute time trial period, the group that did the protocol went 1 kilometer further. And in timed events, that's extremely significant. And that's doing nothing other than hydrating with sodium and water prior to exercise, and not just water only. And so this is where, by keeping track of these gains and losses, if you don't have that sodium as part of your diet, that 1 kilometer can be the difference in your distance athletes. In addition to just, you know, your football athletes or aerobic capacity is important for all sports, not just distance. So this can definitely be seen across the board in other sports as well. Did you have something to say, Jeremy? Sorry, I didn't know if you were asking a question.
Well, I was just trying to... I almost want you to repeat the what you're talking about on this slide. So, can you repeat that?
Yeah, so what we were looking at in the previous slides was it's rehydration period, no matter what by hour two, everybody was dehydrated. I like to say hypohydrated, but whatever you want to call it, they were in fluid deficit. So this is kind of changing tracks a little bit. So what happens if we go before exercise? These recommendations we're going to give athletes say, hey, this is how you prepare for your competition. So instead of focusing on simple sodium only after exercise, that whole window following exercise to preparing the next day can give you a performance gain. So what in this study they did, they had two groups, basically professionally trained cyclists, ingest 165 millimoles of sodium, which is actually greater than any of the studies we've looked at so far, with water, rest, and then go through the same exercise protocol. And then at the very end of it, do a time trial, which is where they're told to go all out and see who can go furthest in those 10 minutes. The group that did the sodium with water went a full kilometer further in the same period of time as the group that didn't. And this is a result of, you can see on the left, the little black line, mm-hmm. that's the top. What that means is they had a plasma volume expansion, so they actually had a greater aerobic capacity than the group that didn't do that. And that's just simply playing with human physiology in a way that you can be a part of your diet, simply with sodium and water. Nothing else.
All right, now go back to the numbers. You said 160 millimoles of sodium. Is that right?
Yep.
And what is it? It was 10 in a bottle of Powerade?
Yeah, 10.
So that would be 16 bottles of Powerade between the end of a workout to the next.
Yeah. So essentially, they pretty much, and in that particular, I mean, if people following along are getting missing the conversions with millimoles, 160 is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3 grams of sodium. So you can measure that out on your kitchen scale with table salt and kind of see, you know, the types, the amounts of sodium that people need to be ingesting for this particular. And we know these exist. We know this isn't in especially hot climates, this is a typical loss that needs to be replaced with your athletes. And so this is just an example of how by replacing that and taking that into consideration will result in a performance increase.
Okay.
And if you go to the next slide, so what this was, the next slide, this was done by Sims et al. And this is where they actually had people do a very similar thing. For those that are actually following along, there's actually a drinking protocol for this on the right side of this slide. So this is what the subjects did. And this kind of gets at a little bit of a discussion here from like the practical application of things. So how do we do this? And so to take account when you time things, how much to drink, this study does all of it. So the best way to hydrate is by drinking small, equal amounts over a period of time and not a whole lot right away. Because if you drink a whole lot right away, your stomach will empty, your body will say, hey, I've got too much water, and then it'll have to get rid of it without actually utilizing it. So we refer to that as involuntary dehydration because your body thinks it's doing what you want it to do. But in reality, it's just a false sense of hydration. And a lot of people see this as clear urine. So they're really hypohydrated, urine's a really dark color, and they'll drink two or three of these, and then 30 to 45 minutes later, they have clear urine, they're not hydrated. And this is one of the things that we need to keep an eye on, because the body's artificially getting rid of that and it's not actually distributing it to the extracellular fluid space and intercellular fluid spaces to create fluid balance. It's kind of a dirty trick our kidneys in that scenario. So that's why if you drink small amounts over a period of time, your body's gonna utilize it much better. And in this particular study, they did it in 30-minute increments for an hour and a half leading up to exercise. So what they did was they did the math on how much they were expected to lose based off sweat testing. and they drank in equal amounts in a semi-recumbent position, so they sat in a recliner, did move for 90 minutes, did their warm-up period, and then they ran on treadmills. And then at the end of the exercise period, they were told to run to exhaustion. So whenever they hit the red button and tap out, and the group that actually did the sodium loading, which you see on this slide, went 20 minutes longer than the group that didn't. Again, this is a purely aerobic running test. I don't know how this exactly translates directly to sports, but 20 minutes is a significant time to exhaustion compared to a group that didn't do it. So there's definitely gains to be had simply by pre-hydrating before exercise, which is what this is getting at.
Well, I mean, obviously here at Pasadena, we deal with cross country or track. So if we're dealing specifically with running, then it would seem like this is an obvious win for track athletes.
And it's an easy win too. That's the thing. It's like, this isn't, I hate to use the words ergogenic aid because everybody thinks you're dealing with like blood doping and things like that. But in reality, you're using your own body's physiology as an ergogenic aid. It's water and sodium, it's fluid balance. And it's just timing and staying hydrated. And these are the types of gains you can get simply by just being diligent with it. And that's the biggest thing that I try to get across to people is these are simple things that athletes can do that result in big performance decreases. Maybe it's not going to be 20 minutes in a 5K, but maybe it's a minute. That's the difference between a podium and going home. So, I mean, these are things that seconds can be, you know, we're down to seconds in the elite levels. This can be seconds, you know, assuming strategy and all things considered equal. And so these are a couple studies that just demonstrate these are easy things. Nothing crazy, no fancy products that cost hundreds of dollars a month. Water and table salt. There you go. And this particular study is by Sims et al., and they've got two of them. And if you look them up, they have the full protocol that they did, including how much sodium was in the water, how they drank it, and the exercise protocol. And it's easily reproducible in any setting.
All right, that's interesting. So I'd be interested. I mean, today we have district track, so obviously it wouldn't work today because I wouldn't have time to read and get everything ready. But it'd be interesting to see if maybe next week, you know, I could do something to kind of help them out. Again, not cheating or anything, but using your body's own physiology, like you just said.
Yeah, it's not cheating at all. Then we've actually got studies that say, especially in the high school population, somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% of athletes start practice in a hypohydrated state to begin with. So this is healthcare. It's not cheating. It's just making sure you're doing what's right for your athletes. For those in the more elite settings that are listening, this isn't just, like I said, a high school problem. They've got all sorts of studies that show this is common in professional basketball around the world and other things. And this is easy. Like we like to, a lot of athletic trainers get really militant. Like I don't give water. I do more than just water. But it's like, hey, this is energy system development. This is the foundation of, you know, homeostasis. And if you're not saying you need to walk around and hand people, you know, water bottles and squirt water bottles in their mouth, which, as an aside, there's a good study in the Journal of Athletic Training by Susan Juergen that found squirting water bottle into football players' mouths actually contributes to less fluid replaced during activity. So she actually figured out a way to kind of test that. It's in the JAT. It's a pretty good read. So hopefully kind of changing that strategy up a little bit. Because I don't know about you guys, but I don't like seeing athletic trainers reduced to that. But these are recommendations we can give athletes on a realistic basis. You don't have to walk around and hand the water bottles. Kind of what we do here is we can I've got a lot of these recommendations printed up and posted on walls in locker rooms, over urinals, in bathroom stalls. So, you know, people are always seeing information on how to help themselves if they're not always around me.
All right.
So one of the things we get into is like, okay, so I just spent now 30 slides telling you nothing works except. So I did this slide specifically because these are all really common. There's a lot of assumptions around this sort of thing, and we like to say that we looked a lot at the science of it to see what these assumptions are actually true. So if you go to the next slide, I've been told by some people, I'm one of the pickle juice people, but I'd like to blame Kevin Miller, the second author on my study, because he did it first. It's his fault, but it's kind of, we're looking at this idea, not that we're obsessed with pickle juice necessarily, but Kevin did a study that was a survey that found somewhere in the neighborhood of a quarter or more of athletic trainers use pickle juice to treat muscle cramps. So into this whole, this descent into why are they treating muscle cramps, another curious result of that survey was the assumption that they're replacing electrolytes lost during exercise with. So really the purpose of the study wasn't because we're obsessed with just getting flaccid pickles and eating the pickles because I just need the juice. It's this idea of sodium replacement during activity and how we're doing it. And obviously this is very practical because you can just go to a grocery store, strain pickle juice, and there you go. There's nothing fancy about it. But what we found is after exercise, so I had people exercise in a heat chamber for an hour at 80% of their VO2 max. And on three different conditions, they either drank absolutely nothing for the entire period following exercise, one bolus of pickle juice or two boluses of pickle juice, nothing significantly changed between any of those groups. So here's this idea that I gave people pickle juice during exercise, only before or not at all, and there was no difference. And I think this gets back to what we talked about earlier in the presentation of the things that delay gastric emptying. So pickle juice is very acidic, very high osmolality because it's very concentrated, and it's a small volume. So here's these things that people are taking during exercise with the assumption it's sodium that they're putting back, and realistically, nothing's happening. It's not even leaving their stomach. As an aside, part of the reason they think this works is it's the white vinegar acetic acid in pickle juice is stimulating surface nerve endings in the roof of the mouth and having some interactions with afferent, efferent signals signaling to the muscles. And I think they're starting to see that, I think, a little bit more in some animal studies, but they haven't exactly shown that in humans yet, but I know they're working on it. So that's typically how they think that's working. so for people that hate pickle juice, theoretically, you could not even have to drink it. The idea is maybe you can even swish it around in your mouth and spit it out, and that's all you need to do. You don't actually have to swallow it. So keep that in mind as we go forward here.
All right, so eating the pickle is not what you want. It's the ingesting the pickle juice, which even at minimum, you could just switch the pickle juice around in your mouth. For me, that would be disgusting because I hate pickles. But eating the pickles would require the breakdown, the digestion, and all that stuff. So it's the drinking the pickle juice. And tell me again, did it matter before, during, or after?
No, not at all. And so, because in the study, on the 0 day, basically people showed up, they did my exercise protocol and sat there till 125 minutes post-exercise and did nothing. They didn't drink water. They didn't ingest anything. And that group's blood data was the same as the group that had up to 2 grams of sodium during the same period. And their blood data was not significantly different. You can see in the chart or the graph I have here that there does appear to be some difference, but that's within scientific means. So clinically, it's not significant. You're not going to notice the difference clinically because this is within 140 to 144. That's normal blood sodium levels. If we were going above 147, below 138, that's a bigger result. But this is this is standard. This is what humans do. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Cool. So then, if anybody has a soccer team, and I know Texas just finished up their winter season with women's soccer. Do the men play in the winter too there?
The playoffs are going on right now. So actually, this week coming up would be the state tournament here in Texas.
So you're going to love the next slide then. So go to the next slide. We're already there. Okay. So plasma potassium content changes after banana ingestion in exercised men. So we've got a male population that went through an exercise protocol. All clinical values are within standard norms with potassium during exercise. Where you start to see the differences is up to an hour after exercise. And this isn't someone that's sitting in a chair, not moving. That's important because every time you move, your plasma characteristics and fluid compartments and electrolyte distribution is going to change because all those fluids are moving to account for a difference in body position. So they weren't able to get a change until 60 minutes with somebody sitting absolutely still. So the idea that I'm going to replace potassium and not cramp by crushing bananas at halftime of a soccer match is not likely the case. And plus they had to drink, eat up to 2 full servings of bananas to even get a change, which is important to note. So that's something to keep in mind of if people want to like spend their time, you don't have a lot of time at halftime, instead of trying to crush food that's not going to leave their stomach for the second half, maybe focus a couple different strategies for comfort and some other things in that 15 to 30 minute window that you have to get to the field or get back out on the field. And that's where you'll notice that a little bit more. Or likewise, if you do need an increase in potassium, if it took 60 minutes to get that into their system, then you shouldn't be doing it right before a game or at halftime. You should be doing it a minimum of 60 minutes before you play or more. So that's where we want to get into the timing of this. If that's something I probably didn't outline too good earlier in here with the hydration, it's all about timing less than when, or like, you know, during exercise, it's all about the timing of it. And then this study was pretty interesting. So if you go to the next one, oh, you're there. Sorry. Electrolyte and plasma responses after pickle juice, mustard, and deionized water ingestion in dehydrated humans. These people exercised to about 3% body mass loss and afterwards either drank pickle juice, crushed mustard, or deionized water. And the important thing here is after exercise, nothing changed for an hour after exercise. So this is really kind of speaking that these are concentrated things that people are eating. They're probably just sitting in their stomach. They're not working, and we're telling people they're working. The evidence-based approach, here's evidence showing us these recommendations are not accurate when you give them. And I'm not saying you in general, just like I hear these a lot when I get athletes from other, you know, all walks of life that say, hey, these were the recommendations I got in the past. You don't necessarily approach the athlete and say, no, that was wrong. It's like, hey, let's try a different strategy and see how that works. Because that can be threatening to people and then they don't listen to you. So this is something that you can kind of work with that as well. So this next slide, people usually start getting frustrated about this point of like what does work. And I like to tell people you can potentially do 2 things at once. So this is where the chicken noodle soup came from. So this got pretty popular in the NFL playoffs last year because full disclosure, I'm not actually a New England Patriots fan, so I don't have a horse in this race. But when they were beating the Indianapolis Colts in the playoffs last year, there was a picture of Andrew Luck looking really distraught, but he was standing next to a big container that had chicken broth on it during the game. So everybody's like, why do we do this? Every year I'm on the Boston Marathon medical staff, which we'll be doing Monday. We have chicken bouillon that we can give to people that might be in a sodium deficit situation at my point on the course. But why is this? And the studies here are kind of what we're getting at with that. So the study by Ray et al. Was looking at post-exercise hydration with food. Okay, so this is ideally an athlete finishes exercise, now what? What do they do? And this is kind of the hallmark study that the now what do we do? So they ingested an entire can, 12 ounces of chicken noodle soup. And I believe if I read the study correctly, it was actually just Campbell's chicken noodle soup, the can we've all seen for, you know, 50, 60 years unchanged. And once they ate that broth, chicken noodle soup, everything in that can, they just drank water throughout the evening. And what this graph shows is they either did that or they did chicken broth and they did a carbohydrate electrolyte drink only, which was just say a Powerade or Gatorade, or then they just drank water. The sports drink and the water group did not have a meaningful difference in their plasma sodium changes for quite some time after exercise. And the chicken broth and the chicken noodle soup group got extremely close to fluid balance and actually didn't have to replace 150%. They only had to replace 100% of fluid loss. So now they're starting to move the goalposts a little bit on how much water the NATA, the ACSM recommend simply by ingesting a can of chicken noodle soup. Part of the reason is think about all the things that are in food, right? And we talked about gastric emptying earlier in the presentation. Food has all these carbohydrates, starches, sugars, all these things that help with diffusion across the small intestine that'll take water with it. And as a result, it's utilized better in the body. And that's usually why this is the case. Chicken noodle soup is kind of like this catch-all. I suppose you can do it with ramen too, even though they didn't do it, but it's really high in sodium content. I think honestly, it's 2,300 milligrams per serving, last I looked at it. So I think there's a lot of reasons why, almost like old wives' tales, where they say when you're sick and like maybe you're under a lot of fluid loss, you'd feel better if you drink chicken noodle soup. I think this is primarily the reason, is your body's actually retaining fluids better. That if you're really ill, you would otherwise be losing. And I think this is part of the reason. This is a scientific reason. I think that I know my grandmother always yelled at me if I was sick, eat chicken noodle soup. This is part of the reason I think why it works.
Okay, so as we're talking about basically hydration, or chicken noodle soup is the new gold standard in rehydration, what does that do to recovery? Because chocolate milk for so long has been the gold standard for recovery after a workout. So how do those play together?
I think that's a good question, because depending on who you talk to, I don't think those things taste really good together. Personally, I wouldn't do that, not even close. So I think a lot of what the chocolate milk's getting at is not necessarily from a rehydration standpoint, but getting a lot of the good carbs and things for replacing glycogen stores and muscle recovery and that sort of thing. Where chicken noodle soup fits in that, I honestly don't have a good answer for that. I think there's definitely nutrients in chicken noodle soup that'll contribute from a protein standpoint with the chicken, because if you hit that 30-minute window of ingestion following exercise to increase glycogen stores with protein and some other products, I think you can probably get that with chicken noodle soup, but I don't know if I actually have evidence to support that. So I don't want to go out and say yes. But I would be remiss to say, if you're not eating something in that window, that it's not contributing. So do you have to crush chocolate milk when it's 95 degrees outside in Houston, Texas, or eat hot chicken noodle soup? I don't know which one's the better in that scenario. I don't know which one's actually better, but it's cold up here in the Northeast, so either I think is usually fine. But honestly, I don't know. And if I'm weighing the differences on both, like which one would be better for me, I would say you'd want to bias it towards probably your sodium and electrolyte replacement, because simply because that's going to give you the better foundation to work from as an athlete, simply not just replacing protein, if that makes any sense. And there was actually a study that came out, I don't have it in this presentation, that demonstrated that whey protein contribute to hydration in beverages it's added to. So I know there's some stuff at GNC I saw last week that make that claim, and it's the article came out that I can send it, the citation to you, that actually demonstrates that's not true. So, which is good to know, because it gets at that. If we replace sodium with all the other aspects of food, your body's going to hold on to it better. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I was just wondering, because, you know, I can't imagine somebody drinking chocolate milk and having a bowl of hot soup at the same time.
That's gross. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of athletes will do what it takes to do. So if they are getting the benefit out of both, but I know it's a practical thing to do, because I think a lot of athletic trainers ask, like, okay, I get a lot of heat because I'm in a Division I setting. So it's like, okay, you have a budget, you have this, this, and this. I'm an outreach AT at a high school, which is actually how I started my career. What do I do in these scenarios? And it's like, hey, I don't care what chicken noodle soup it is. It could be your grandmother's recipe. It's usually fairly salty. Anybody can get that. You can go to the grocery store. That's not some fancy product. And I don't know if you've talked about nutritional supplements on the past. Since it is a food product, it's regulated by the FDA, so you can actually believe what's on its label, whereas opposed to a lot of supplements that are not regulated by the FDA, you're taking their word for it, so to speak. So you can be a little bit more information.
All right.
So kind of getting through here to kind of wrap up before I start answering questions, because I know there's always questions with this is basically a modified, I have this poster printed up and posted all around our facilities here, but basically, as you can gather from the studies I've shown, it does not matter what you drink, whether it's water or sports drinks, during activity, because you won't completely replace electrolytes, and you don't need to completely replace all your fluids. You just need to get to that 70% range. So you can drink water, sports drinks, it doesn't matter, especially for athletes that, say, have gastric upset because of sugar. They can't have sports drinks. All they can have is water. That athlete is not any better or worse off than an athlete who drinks a sports drink during exercise, regardless of what every commercial during sports will tell you. Science tells us those two athletes are going to be the same, okay? And you drink to thirst during practice. You should not gain weight during training. This prevents overdrinking and those hyponatremic situations we talked about earlier. A lot of athletes, especially with the body image, are concerned with weight loss during exercise. Like, this is a goal of theirs. Weight loss is normal, but you should return to your regular weight by the start of the next training session. It shouldn't be a continual progression over the course of a week into a game day. Otherwise, I can tell you without even knowing that athlete, they're not going to perform as well as they should, whether it's a Friday Night Lights or soccer game or tennis match, basketball, doesn't matter. Okay. And that rehydration takes hours, not minutes. If any of those studies demonstrated anything, it's that if we don't pay attention to this beyond a 2-hour window after practice, they're going to be in fluid deficit if they do nothing, which unfortunately is really common, especially when you're limited with your ability to talk with these athletes. It's good to have them understand that, hey, I finished practice at 4 or 5 o'clock. By 7 or 8, I need to start continuing to drink water again before I go to bed and when I get up in the morning, so they constantly stay ahead. And small equal amounts every 20 to 30 minutes, that's again to aid in your body absorbing those amounts of fluid. And do not drink as much fluid as fast as possible. As we talked about earlier, this leads to involuntary dehydration because the urine gets clear pretty quickly. And it gets this false sense of hydration status, a good hydration status. So those are the things that you want to keep in mind.
Okay, so to kind of go back and see that I understand, the pickle juice didn't have an effect within the 2 hours. Drinking pickle juice didn't have an effect if they were sitting still after they performed.
Correct. And then in my particular study, I actually gave it to them during activity too. So I simulated about when a halftime would occur. So that's like they would stop, drink, and then start exercising again. And there was still no change in one of the conditions. So that's correct.
Right. Chicken broth, if consumed within, you said 30 minutes or an hour of...
Honestly, anytime. The reason I said 30 minutes is because if we're getting at the chocolate milk discussion of like replacing glycogen stores and proteins and that sort of stuff, if you time chicken noodle soup to that window, you can probably get some of the similar benefits because of just the ingredients, you know, the proteins and things with chicken and stuff like that. But realistically, you could, if you noticed you had a problem an hour and a half after exercise, you're ingesting sodium and then drinking water after it. So I would say within an hour, we'll get someone in good habits to like monitor throughout the evening.
All right. So then obviously you said just this, the can that was in that study, from what you understood, is just a regular, because obviously they have low sodium chicken noodle soup, and that's not what we want, right?
Yeah. No, that's like the normal standard, I think, 89 cents to $1.15, you know, can of chicken noodle soup. That's all that is.
All right, and then from that, like you just said, you continue to drink water afterwards. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just water.
And then if you were to try and use Powerade or Gatorade, sports drink in general, to replace fluids, it would take somewhere around 15 bottles of Powerade to replace the electrolytes that you've lost during an hour and a half of activity.
Correct. And that's why we like to bring that up, is because that's entirely unreasonable, because they didn't lose that much fluid. So that's what leads to that over drinking, this idea that I can replace that much of an electrolyte loss with a sports drink actually creates an extremely dangerous situation. So if there's one thing anybody listening takes away from this, is that they should not be drinking sports drinks to replace electrolytes, because that's, you know, unfortunately we have the negative reminder of Zaire's Oliver in his memory to remind us that what can happen if they do that.
Right. So Jason has a question about the Gatorade chews or the Prime products, the pouches, but yeah. I'm just thinking, like, we provide Gatorade throughout the game.
Mm-hmm.
Am I negatively impacting the athlete? Because like you said, there's the gastric emptying. You know, we're not giving them bananas and things like that because, you know, not to stop in the middle of the third quarter and go to the bathroom or something. But am I negatively impacting my athletes by giving them that Gatorade?
No. And that's important to realize as well. The only time that I think they'll be negatively impacted is when they start drinking in amounts that exceed what they lose. So that's the biggest thing, and I'll repeat that. If you drink an amount of fluid, regardless of what it is, that exceeds what you're losing in sports, that's when they do a disservice. That could even be water, not just Gatorade. That's anything. So no, you're not doing them a disservice. I think it's more along the lines of from fluid replacement, that's fine. But when you add electrolyte replacement into the equation, that's where we kind of have to shift our recommendations.
Okay.
And the other thing is, so some athletes are like, drinking behavior, there's a whole field of study of just drinking behavior, not looking at necessarily physiology, but do I drink this drink more or this one more, depending on how it tastes. And that, so some athletes will either, they'll drink nothing before they don't drink Gatorade. So if they don't have Gatorade, they'll drink nothing. And that's also a situation we don't want. So in that case, you know, water's fine, but if that athlete's not gonna drink anything, Gatorade's fine too. That's important. Gatorade, Powerade, all sport from when I was in high school. So I mean, anything like that would be okay.
All right, so to Jason's question, do you have thoughts on the Gatorade Prime chews or pouches?
Looking at some of those things, I don't think the chews especially don't have, the chews are really good about having something in your stomach. They really help with that. And for most of our high school sports, I think there's a negligible effect during activity with those types of products. Now, when we start getting into marathon, ultra endurance, things like that, where you're exercising for greater than 90 minutes, ingesting the carbohydrates in that form is actually very useful and highly recommended. So when you talked with your guests about, you know, marathon healthcare and diet and things like that, that's usually where you see that stuff come out, is it's like, okay, the world records for marathon are somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 hours. These are the fastest humans on the planet over 26 point, you know, over the marathon distance, and it's still taking them 2 hours to get there. So at that point, these people might need to ingest something because their body's going to expend energy over an extremely long period of time. And then you start backing off that a little bit to where when the people run by my station and a mile before the finish line, they've been exercising for 3 to 4 hours. You need to ingest stuff like those chews, goos, number of products you can find at running stores, doesn't really matter, whatever tastes good to you. Something to get those carbohydrates in your system in addition with, you know, fluids. So that's usually where that stuff comes in. But for our average athletes that are practicing for an hour, hour and a half, and then going home, fairly negligible if they keep their diet in check.
All right. So if they're eating properly, then it's kind of just something that they want rather than can need or can really use.
Yeah. And that's the other thing, the psychology, that's really important. So if someone has their sleeve of Gatorade chews, and let's say baseball always gets a bad rap because they are always accused of sitting in the dugout and doing nothing until they actually have to do something. But if you got a baseball player who's like, if I don't have my chew or two before I go out to the mound or I go out to take an at bat, I'm not going to bat as well because I didn't have my Gatorade sport chew. That's important. Is it negligible? Possibly, but that might affect the sports performance. So there's a whole psychology aspect of that that I don't think you're doing harm to this athlete by necessarily letting them have it. I will say that I don't think there's any need to supplement potassium at all, and that are really high in it. And I would stray away from stuff like that in a healthy athlete. Obviously, if somebody's sick and they've had a lot of fluid losses, that's a different, you know, they're under the guidance of a physician. But if, like me sitting here, totally healthy, I don't need to supplement potassium. And that's where I think some of those products go a little overboard. Because in strenuous muscle activity, your body's actually trying to actively get rid of potassium because there's too much of it circulating in the bloodstream. And then some of these products actively try to put it back, and it kind of can create some havoc in the system.
Right. And then, so like I was talking about track going on right now, district, you know, we have two kids that are probably going to advance, but they're also those same kids that run the 2 mile and then like 2 hours later turn around and run the 1 mile. So if they're running the 2 mile, that's like what, maybe 8-10 minutes or something like that. Do I need to consider the electrolyte loss there? Because 2 hours, that's when you said they're going to be at the greatest deficit if they're not continuing. How do I manage that?
You manage that in the 5 days leading up to the meet. So what you want to do is you want to make sure is their training throughout the week, that through their diet after training throughout the evening and the next day, is making up for that. So then when they get into their 10-minute competition window, you don't have an issue. Or when you get to that 2 hours events, that they just have to like drink, maybe eat small things, because that's especially a population where weight gain is going to be a performance decrease. So you don't want them crushing all these products necessarily. So if they start in a good place before the meet, then that way you don't have to worry about it. They can go through their routine, their process, their strategy, and not negatively impact their approach on competition day.
Okay. Well, I think that's about all I have for you. It looks like you got someone knocking on your door or something, huh?
Huh? No. Oh,
okay.
So you I have a notepad that I was making sure I had everything.
Okay. I think that sums it up pretty much. You know, your tips, again, that's a great thing. You said you have that as a poster where it talks about the sports drinks doesn't really make a difference during the activity as long as you're replacing fluids. Drink to thirst. Weight loss during exercise is normal. You shouldn't gain weight from fluids during practice. Rehydration takes hours. Drink small, equal amounts. And then don't drink large amounts fast.
Correct.
So I think all those are good practical tips. The chicken broth is something that I've kind of seen, you know, seen the pictures on Twitter and stuff like that. But that's something that's new, and that's really, I just didn't understand it because, you know, I don't read all the articles and things like that. So, again, that's why I have people like you.
Yeah, and I'm here to tell you it works. But if you read the research and you want to take a pure EBP approach with that exercise, all that research has nothing to do with during exercise. None of it. All of it's either in the pre-hydration period and hours or so leading up to exercise, or the rehydration period. None of those were during exercise. So anybody taking that during exercise is purely guessing and hoping for the best.
And then there was the study in there, I think you said it was Sims et al., about the high osmolality sodium where they went like 20 minutes longer or something.
That's
like
a cool study, man. That's a cool study to read.
So, yeah, interesting stuff that, you know, I mean, it just seems like, well, why is everybody not doing this well? Because people like me, I don't know about it. I didn't read it. So,
yeah. And that's the thing. It's like we always talk about, I think there's a really good, I meant to send you the link. The Corey Stringer Institute put out a really, really, really good YouTube video on all of this that, you know, I don't know if it helps me out, but basically sums all this infographic video. And I'll see if I can find that link and send it to you. But it was fantastic. And it really kind of gets at this whole idea. It's kind of changing the approach to hydration than what we're used to, because it's the same thing. All the stuff that we try and prevent sudden death in sport, heat stroke, things like that, thermoregulation is but how you improve hydration status. So it's making sure we, you know, lay that foundation so we're able to adequately prevent or help prevent the potential catastrophic situations.
And then there was a quote in there. You said you don't, you know, the argument about people like, I don't dispense water, that's below me. But you said it's the energy system building block. What did you call it?
Energy system development.
Development. There you go. I like that. Energy system development. It's a good way to think about that.
Yeah, because that's an entirely different, you know, lecture we could give is, okay, when we're looking at manipulating aerobic capacity, well, what's aerobic capacity? At its very basic level, it's the fluids in your body, how they're regulated, how they get to tissues, how they buffer hydrogen, and plasma volume. That's hydration. So even at the highest levels or even at the amateur levels, it's the same. The human body is the same. The standard deviations for a lot of the blood stuff I gave you was somewhere in the neighborhood of one. So that's how humans live. So it drives me nuts when people, you know, dismiss this because it's a bigger picture, and you can really achieve some really positive training goals by paying attention to it.
All right, so now what I got to figure out is if my company School Health is going to start selling chicken broth so I can buy it with the budget so I can get it to the kids so we can do ergonomic, what did you call it, ergocentric?
Well, usually when you take in, I think in the ATEP programs now, they call it like, in drug and sport classes, ergogenic aids are usually when they talk about blood doping and how cyclists manipulate, you know, aerobic capacity and stuff like that, but it's not necessarily in a negative context. It's just this is your body's own ergogenic aid. It's trying to keep your plasma volume so your heart functions appropriately, you have an appropriate aerobic capacity, and hydration is the most direct way to influence that. Like, I can take your best athlete and through hydration break them in 2 days. Doesn't matter. Like, that's the foundation we're dealing with here.
That's all I got, Mike.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, I appreciate you having me on. Hopefully it wasn't too dense of information.
No, I think it's good. And then, you know, for me, I feel like you're kind of, you said, you know, you really enjoy looking at the research. For me, I really don't enjoy looking at the research. And so together, I think it makes it a lot more palatable for me and for probably a lot of other people. So,
yeah, I actually get entertainment out of reading research as soon as it comes out. So
I know I saw Josh's tweet, Josh Ogden, about he did like 3 articles that he was going to be reading while he was in the hotel at wherever they were playing baseball. I was like, oh, my goodness, these guys.
Hotel time means reading time.
Yeah, well. So, I got 3 kids. Hotel means sleep time.
Yeah, that too. I understand that. So,
all right. Well, Mike, I know we can find you on Twitter, McKinney_ATC, or at GoNU Performance for Northeastern University, or m.mckinney@neu.edu. So it's m.mckinney@neu.edu. Very, very helpful. I see him on Twitter a lot, interacts with a lot of stuff there. So definitely reach out to Mike if you have other questions, if you want to talk to him. He may even Skype into whatever program that you're leading and do the same or similar presentation. He said he's got other levels of this presentation, so one that's a little bit lower than what we did today and one that's a little bit more advanced than what we did today. So if you're looking for more or less, hit him up and then get him in as part of your program. So
perfect. Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you.
Cool. And if you're visiting Boston like I am this summer, then hit him up as well, because he's got tons of knowledge that I just wouldn't have thought of. So
yeah, and I'm always happy to show visiting, you know, healthcare providers around campus and show our facilities and care model. So no worries with that.
Very cool. Maybe that'll be what we do on that one off day there. So I know I'm excited about going to the Boston Red Sox game that we're planning on. We'll have to see. We'll be there for the 4th of July weekend and get to see the fireworks on the top of that building.
It's a good time.
So, all right. Well, for Jeremy, Mike McKinney there in Boston, the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/hydration. Again, that's where the whole slideshow that he went through today, and I actually typed in notes of things that I picked up in the notes section there. I didn't mess up the presentation, but I typed in notes. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/hydration. That's where you can find this presentation, and it also have links to ways to contact Mike as well. So Mike, that's a wrap.
All right, cool. Thanks,
Mike.
Thank you.
Bye.